Cocktail College is brought to you by George Dickel. Let me tell you a little story, listener. From the very beginning, as one of the oldest distilleries in Tennessee, George Dickel was determined to do things differently, rethink American whiskey using fresh spring water as well as tried and true distillation techniques. And here's why I'm excited to partner with Dickel today. Because whether you're talking Tennessee whiskey or bourbon, Dickel actually puts both of those different types of spirits out there. You can argue the differences between yourselves. And when it comes to sipping, we're talking high age statements with some of the best value you can find in American whiskey. Seriously, we've been fans here at Vine Pair for years. We've championed Dickel for years, which is why it's so awesome to be partnering today. But this is a cocktail podcast, so let's talk about mixing options. I like to turn to the Dickel Bourbon, which feels just at home in those classic cocktails that we always cover here, as well as those modern classics we like to get into as well. Listener, head to georgedickel.com/recipes to get inspired and start mixing with our old pal, George Dickel. Cheers.
Hey, this is Tim McCurdy, and welcome to Vine Pair's Cocktail College, a weekly deep dive into classic cocktails that goes beyond the recipe with America's best bartenders.
It's not really a thing normal people drink, and I don't know if either me or you are normal, but it's certainly not something you can sell for $50 a pour, a 1960s beef eater, so you got to turn that into something.
If cult craft beers and the modern bourbon boom have taught us anything, it's that booze brands and certain specific products can absolutely become collector's items. For proof, just look at Pappy Mania or the Blanton Bros who post cringeworthy crotch shots on Reddit. But these pursuits pale amateur in comparison to the efforts of vintage spirits collecting Dusty Hunters. If you thought it was tough to snag an allocated Buffalo Trace release, consider tracking down 100-year-old bottles from long-shutter distilleries or product lines that have been discontinued for decades. Shockingly, there are those for whom this is not only a hobby, but who've worked it into their professional lives by way of their bar programs. Perhaps you've seen them for yourselves, because these days, vintage spirit selections are fairly common on menus. I actually just encountered one in a hotel bar, albeit one that was part of an upscale-ish mini chain. But vintage cocktails? That's a whole other story entirely. An even bigger pursuit, dependent on deep stocks of products that are quite literally becoming extinct in front of our eyes. But it is happening. That's right, your martinis, Manhattans, and Negronis, they're all receiving the dusty treatment at bars, both home and public. And here to explore this fascinating phenomenon is Aaron Goldfarb, Vine Pair writer at large and author of the just published book on this very topic, Dusty Booze. Listener, it's pre-phylloxera cognac, prohibition-era rum, and a cocktail so rare, only a handful of living drinkers can boast to have tasted it. And it's all right here on the Cocktail College podcast. He's been a Vine Pair contributor for, I want to say, at least 7 years now. But today, his first time officially in the Cocktail College studio, it's Aaron Goldfarb, everyone. Aaron, welcome to the show.
You know, thanks for having me. We've had many conversations over the years, many drinks over the years, but this is my first time to talk to podcast Tim, so I'm very excited about that.
Different energy, Tim, that you get than maybe in the bar there, but that's a different story.
You don't really sound like this in person. You put on a special, like, lower the voice.
Podcast voice. It's the cool vibes of the studio here. And obviously that was a little different last week when we went live, or 2 weeks ago when we went live in Sunken Harbor Club, but looking forward to hearing how everyone felt that one went down. It was a fun event. But listen, Aaron, we're here for different business today. You got a new book coming out.
Yes.
Dusty Booze, probably the same week, actually exactly the same week that this comes out. Want to get some info on that. But before we do, I want to set a little scene here for the listeners. So the year is 2021. The date, if I recall correctly, even is December 10th.
Okay.
Omicron is silently surging through New York and set to really mess up everyone's holiday travel plans, including very nearly my own. Yourself and I were blissfully unaware of this.
Yes.
Inside Maison Premiere, about to enjoy A vintage Sazerac. Tell us the story behind that.
Well, you know.
The real story here.
You know, if you listen to my friend Tim's podcast voice, you can tell he's not an American. That summer was the Ryder Cup. And as men are wont to do, we made a bet. The U.S. always loses the Ryder Cup, but I still took the bet. And the bet was whatever side wins, the other man has to pay for this, I think, $100 vintage Sazerac at Maison Premiere made with, you know, I can't recall what it was, a 1940s cognac.
1946 cognac, yeah.
Yeah, so a real glorious cocktail. The U.S. won, maybe you recall, if you're...
Don't recall that one.
A golf fan and a cocktail fan. Not a lot of, not a major Venn diagram of golf enthusiasts and cocktail enthusiasts. But the U.S. won. But Tim also won because I felt so bad. I bought him the second best vintage cocktail on the menu, and we kind of shared them both. That was a vintage rye Sazerac.
Sazerac, yeah. Maison Premier's. I believe, yeah, this is part of their tableside Sazerac service, which
tableside.
You know, is fantastic. And, you know, I bring that up because I definitely don't think it was your first ever vintage cocktail. It wasn't mine, but it's the only that we've shared together.
Yeah.
That is the topic of today's episode.
And we paid
episode.
For them. We didn't even comp them on a publicist tab.
This was on our own dime,
our
people,
own dime,
you
yes.
know. But yeah, that was our first vintage cocktail, I believe, that we've enjoyed together, perhaps our only. And it's perfect for today's show because, you know, you've come out with this fantastic book, Dusty Booze. I'm gonna get your take on it, the info on the book shortly. But I just want to say, you know, from my perspective, reading through that after I received an advanced copy recently, I love the fact that this is a story of drinking culture because booze is kind of, as you mentioned in the book, you know, we could be talking about baseball cards. We could be talking about pogs even, you know, and Pez dispensers and things like that. But how that nature of collecting relates to people who have an obsession with alcohol, some of whom don't even drink. I think my favorite part about the book is, as you mentioned in it, you can read through it all as kind of like a narrative and one story, but also within each chapter, you've got all these different dusty bottles, recommendations, or things that people kind of hunt for and look out for, the most coveted. The kind of, if you want to take a slight break from the narrative, you can look at that, you can catch up on that. Tell us a little bit more. Tell us about dusty spirits, dusty hunting, vintage booze.
Yeah, well, this started with, I've been covering dusty spirits for like the last decade. It's something that really captured my imagination. I was a collector of everything growing up, everything Tim mentioned, baseball cards, comic books, you name it. And those things can teach us about how the world was if we look at them. But I think vintage spirits can teach us so much more about the past. That's not why I'm into them necessarily. I'm into them because in many cases, spirits from the past taste a lot better in an era before multinational conglomerates have ruined these spirits, before celebrities have attached their names to everything, before, you know, products have been dumbed down to lowest common denominator. Before, you know, computer technology and stainless steel has taken over all distilleries. So I initially got into vintage spirits purely out of tasting stuff I thought was better from the past than a lot of stuff being made today. The history comes with those, though.
Yeah, and I think a point that you keep making or keep returning to throughout the book is that, you know, through vintage spirits, there is this kind of tangible aspect of becoming in touch with the past and events. And this is a great way for us to set up someone who's somewhat of a central character throughout the book. It's the world famous Salvatore Calabrese. He's one of the first kind of main figures within the bar world, which is where we're going to, you know, look at this topic through this lens today. He's one of the first to come up in the book, and he keeps appearing throughout. And I believe that's kind of what drew him to the idea of looking into the past to collect vintage bottles. Can you tell us about his story and his kind of pursuit of dusty hunting?
Yeah, well, you know, I think he was drawn to it mainly to make money at first and use the history as a sales point. He was the head barman at Duke's in London before it was kind of the Duke's we know today. I don't quite understand it, but his paycheck was tied towards a commission of sales. Back in that era, before allocated spirits and whatnot, it was kind of hard to raise the ticket price, even if Mick Jagger was coming into the bar and Paul McCartney were coming into the bar, which he promises was true. So his thought was, in this era before Pappy Van Winkle and Macallan and Lalique, was, what if I find vintage spirits? The owner of the hotel said, knock yourself out. And it took him about 2 years to find a single bottle of vintage spirits. It was just not something that was easily accessible. And if someone did have a vintage spirit, they said, well, why do you want this? This has probably gone bad, or it's certainly not good. You certainly shouldn't be selling it at a bar. He knew, like most people now know today, that once bottled, spirits for the most part do not change. If you taste a cognac from 1780, it should taste like it tasted in 1780. Ditto a bourbon from 1960. There are some things that change, and we can discuss those later, but that's why a lot of collectors call these liquid time capsules.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great point. You know, on the one hand, this is really forward thinking, this idea of let's look into the past. Let's look for these examples of bottles that are still around today, because as you said, the whole idea is that they wouldn't change once they're bottled. But then on the other hand, you do, like, he wasn't completely original in the fact that people were doing that with wine, right? Like, there were these great historical vintages that people would seek out and would have value, especially if they were tied to, you know, we can talk about vintages, but especially if they're tied to events that are happening in the world, especially in Europe, especially pre and post and during World War II and historic events like that. That leads to one of the earliest or most notable bottles that you mention in the book that he has there. I believe an old cognac.
Yeah, so after 2 years of looking, he finally talks a private collector into selling him, and I wrote this down because I can't remember it, a 1914 Croisé Bonaparte. Correct pronunciation? I don't know.
Good enough for the show.
And, you know, the collector, I think, sells it to him for £75. You know, what are you going to do with this? It's I don't want it in my collection. It's too old. It's not good. Salvatore puts it on the menu for £15, sells the bottle out in like a week. £15 might not seem remarkable for a pour of spirit these days, but back then I'm assured it was a lot. Okay, now he knows he's onto something. He starts acquiring a lot of cognac from the past, Armagnac from the past. That was what mainly existed and what he could get. And then he starts tying it in to history, as you said. If some drunk Americans are in the bar, he says, well, I got a cognac that was distilled when George Washington was inaugurated. You know, I got a cognac that was bottled when the Civil War ended, you know. So he started tying it to these events and really evoking the history. Unlike we might think of spirits today, a lot of these cognacs don't necessarily have a brand name that a modern customer might know about. You know, stuff like Old Overholt dates back to, you know, pre-prohibition. A lot of these bourbons date back to an era, and gins, you know, longer than anyone on planet Earth has been alive. Not necessarily true for cognac. Hennessy's obviously been around for a while, but a lot of the others haven't. So selling them by kind of these historical markers was his go-to. Sure enough, fairly quickly, he's bringing in about $10,000 a night, £10,000 a night.
Jeez.
From 400 to 500 pounds a night to £10,000 a night. I don't know what his cut was of that, but he accomplished his task of trying to figure out how to get the ticket price up. This was mainly a word of mouth sensation. We should also mention he invented the direct martini sometime around here too, which was a bit of a viral sensation as well and remains to this day. But this was his big claim to fame, and he was the only guy buying vintage spirits, and he was just cleaning out Europe at the time, well ahead of anyone else. He had a decades-long head start, and it is still a collector today.
Mm-hmm. And at this point, is he purely pouring those things as neat pours, or is he starting to experiment with some cocktails as well?
Well, so he starts acquiring entire collections. No one's going to say, you can only take my rare cognac. They say, take my dead husband's entire collection. I don't want any of it. Now, a lot of this stuff is obviously not popular in mid-80s London, bourbon included, of course. Cognac at a nice hotel bar, sure. Maybe scotch. There, you know, wouldn't have been a ton of single malt back then just yet. This is right when single malt's about to hit the scene. So he has a lot of incredible stuff. And he starts playing around with making vintage cocktails, which is a made-up thing. He claims, and there's no way to track this down or prove it, that he at one time had Ray and Nephew 17-year-old, the original rum in the Mai Tai, which it's believed there's only two bottles left on planet Earth. He claims he was making technically accurate 1946 Mai Tais and selling them for £5 back then.
That's, you know, wild.
We'll take his word for it. He's a he's a charismatic showman. It's possibly true. I like to believe it's true. It's in the book. So, you know, what do they say when you don't know the truth? What, I don't know. Something, I mean, from Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
I mean,
if you don't know the truth, print the fable. I don't know. Something like that.
There we go. Yeah. But definitely, I mean, interesting that he would be incorporating tiki drinks into that.
Very
bar.
Strange.
You know,
yes.
Like, it's not what you expect at Duke's. I mean, fantastic, the opportunity. And obviously, a big part of this story further down the line in the future is that what makes some of these things so legendary is because they then become literally extinct. And I think that's a good point, or a great point, that you make early on in the book too, which is like, this is different to a baseball card, because you can own a baseball card and you can be the owner of that for the entirety of your the rest of your life on planet Earth. And then when you go, it's there for someone else, ideally, yeah. Assuming there's no accident or fire or something. but with vintage spirits, especially those who are opening them and tasting them and mixing them in cocktails, once they're gone, they're gone. It is a finite resource that will eventually run out.
Yeah, and it's I think it's the greatest collectible in the world. As I said, I've collected just about everything, from normal things to collect to very stupid things to collect. This is the only thing you can both make a part of your body and share with a buddy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes it, again, the idea of something being tangible, like, takes it to another level. Like, yeah, you can imagine this person held this card, or maybe George Washington wrote this letter, yeah, or something, right? Amazing. But tasting something and taking you back to that time and being like, this is how it was enjoyed 200 years ago or whatever, I think that's really fascinating. After Salvatore, or kind of at the same time, over here in the US, is anyone else pursuing it from, a cocktail standpoint for the purposes of today's show? Do we have any bartenders pioneering programs with and calling out vintage cocktails?
Well, I mean, I don't need to tell you, America's cocktail renaissance, you know, we can say when it starts, 92, 99, 2009, whatever. So there's no vintage cocktails because no one gives an F about cocktails. And likewise, no one really cares about anything but vodka and, you know, Jägermeister and schnapps for many of these years. So no, it would take quite a while from that mid-1980s date till Americans, you know, even know what any cocktails to care about would be. The first kind of American bar to start focusing on vintage cocktails, I believe, is Canon in Seattle. Jamie Boudreau, a Canadian who went over the border to Seattle legally, I'm sure. you know, he opens this bar, Canon, which, if you've been, they got like 180 pages of vintage spirits on an iPad. It's unbelievable. He too has acquired so much vintage that he starts playing around with cocktails. And he told me at first he would sell maybe one a month, and not for that bad a price. I think some are as cheap as, say, $30, maybe up to $75 at the time. They're a lot more now. I checked the menu today, but he has quite a few, and they're not particularly normal ones you'd expect. The most canonical ones, they're a little more obscure vintage, because he has an incredible collection of liqueurs and whatnot. Now he's selling, I don't know, quite a few.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great point as well. You know, when you start casting that net wider, and like you said, someone might not want to sell you just one bottle. They're like, if you want the collection, you got the whole thing or nothing, right? Once you start amassing that collection, then these are the building blocks for cocktails themselves. You start to bring them together, and then it ceases to become solely a vintage spirits program, and you can start thinking about that, right? Like, there's no point in putting on a vintage martini on your menu, and we're going to get into cocktails, like, if you've got one bottle of vintage Gordon's, like, what's the point? It's gone. Yeah. It's gone pretty soon. You might as well just enjoy that with friends. But we have gotten to this point where people are able to do this and somewhat sustain it. I want to get into the categories of different spirits and also liqueurs now when it comes to two different things here. Again, I want us to mainly view things through the lens of cocktails, but let's talk about each different category and also what folks are looking for and what makes something notable within those. And we are going to start with American whiskey, and particularly bourbon, because as you make it very clear in the book, and a large part of the intro to the book at least is devoted to the fact that the bourbon kicks off this modern craze in the US. So yeah, let's talk about the beginning of hunting dusty bourbon.
Yeah, so Salvatore Calabrese was not going to seedy liquor stores in London and trying to find old bottles, as far as I know. He was buying from estates and whatnot and whatever. America's vintage hunting was by guys going to liquor stores in bad neighborhoods and rural locations and finding old granddads from the 1960s and Stitzel Weller bottles from the 50s and buying them for the sticker price that they were stickered in 1950. A lot of these guys were drinking them, not making cocktails out of them. There's kind of an interesting thing where a lot of, you know, bourbon bros, for a lack of a better word, really don't know a lot about cocktails. They know about neat drinking.
Sure.
Maybe they can make an old fashioned using refrigerator ice. you know, maybe they can slop together a Manhattan or something. But there's not really a connoisseurship about cocktails. So they're really not turning this massive amount of dusty bourbon they've acquired into cocktails. They too, though, start acquiring, you know, everything they can find on shelves or from estates or from flea markets or eBay, which legally allowed sales till 2012. And now, you know, what are they going to do with, you know, these bottles of Chartreuse or, you know, Campari or whatnot? Maybe start screwing around with vintage cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Witz is one of the more notable dusty hunters of this very early era. And unlike a lot of the bourbon hunters, he had a passion for ingredients from the past that no longer existed that he could make cocktails with. Abbott's Bitters, which is a very famous bitters from the past, which got reimagined. Creme de Valette makes an Aviation, which was briefly a hot cocktail, now is kind of looked back on, and people are going, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
That did not exist until, I think, 2007, so you kind of had to hunt to find old bottles of it. Amerpicone still does not really exist in America, certainly the name brand Amerpicone. So people like Jamie Boudreau would make their own batch of it. I forget what he calls it, but I think he still uses it at Canon. And other people would hunt and hopefully find Amerpicones, which I think were taken off shelves in America in 1960. So you do get this certain kind of small sect of American dusty hunters looking for these oddball bottles. And back then, they were, you know, people give you free bottles of Amerpicone or Creme de Violette. No one wanted a vintage bottle of any of this stuff. Amerpicone now has quite a value for vintage stuff from the best.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. A lot of these oddballs crop up, and especially some of the ones that we're going to get into that maybe fetch a lot more money these days than people might realize. As I mentioned throughout the book, you kind of have these sections within it that are kind of what we're doing in this section ourselves. Yeah. Right here, right now, right? That, like, what are the notable bottles that are people are looking out for and kind of why? And I think that every step of the way, the ones that gain most acclaim are because of some major event that happened or because of some reason that they can no longer be made in that way. When we're talking about American whiskey and bourbon in particular, right, you know, people often talk about pre-fire Heaven Hill, or
yes,
people are talking about, like, pre-prohibition whiskey or whatnot, or I don't know. You look at any brand where distilleries have changed hands over the years and brands have gone from one distillery to the other. So you have all these events that take place where people are like, well, this is what it tasted like before that thing happened.
Yeah.
Moving on from American whiskey for now, we're going to go to cognac because there is a big event that happens there too, pre-phylloxera. Let's talk about phylloxera because it also has a massive tie into a cocktail we've already mentioned today, the Sazerac, potentially.
Potentially. Yeah. The wine people in the audience know better than me. There were aphids that ate France's grapevine stock that had been planted by the Romans a zillion years ago.
And they came over from America, by the way.
And killed all the grapevines. So there's pre-phylloxera wine, which is quite famous and quite valuable, and it only makes sense. Cognac is distilled wine. There's pre-phylloxera cognac, which gets a little less notoriety. And is not as valuable as you would think. I mean, there are some $20,000 bottles, but, you know, I still go on auction sites and I can find, you know, an 1872 bottle of cognac from a brand you never heard of for $1,000, which seems like an incredible deal to me. And these were a lot of grapevines that no longer exist, varietals and whatnot. So they were very fetishized. It was Salvatore Calabresi's. It is his most beloved vintage spirit to drink. He claims, I think he's tasted 1,000 different bottles of Preflux or cognac. He's the world expert on it, obviously. I'm embarrassingly currently at zero.
Prefiloxera?
Cognac. So same. Maybe we can make another Ryder Cup bet. Although I don't think the U.S. is due.
I think a few points to note there too as well. You draw the parallels with wine, or it's exactly the same thing, but I don't know how well some of those bottles are, most if any of them are holding up pretty well. But
these would hold up. Yeah.
These would hold up. Obviously, though, when we're talking about cocktails, yeah, $1,000 bottle is, relatively speaking, a great value buy, but not something you're going to be able to put into a cocktail. Whereas, like we mentioned, we had that version at Maison Premier where you're like, yeah, 1946, this was made the year after the war in Europe is over. It's like historic. It's incredible. I want to move on to rum now.
Okay.
What are we looking for there? What is the one event or series of events that people might, draw a line in the sand and say everything before this is going to immediately pique our interest and become, you know, very valuable?
Well, for many reasons, rum might be the most interesting and certainly the most challenging vintage category. Cognac comes from one place on planet Earth. Bourbon comes from one place. Tequila comes from one place. Rum comes from every place on planet Earth. And not just island nations. It has been imported and bottled by, you know, Italy and the Netherlands. So if you wanted to hunt vintage rum, you have all of planet Earth. and they all have different flavor profiles. I think another interesting thing about rum is most of the cocktails, obviously, are juice-forward cocktails, and there's no such thing as vintage juice. You asked for the major events. There's a few major events. Castro takes over Cuba in 1959 and nationalizes the distilleries. This is famously when Bacardi leaves Cuba and goes to Puerto Rico. And that's a dividing line, I guess, between the quality of Cuban rum. Jamaica and some of the other island nations, America's their top customer from the time they're making rum. Prohibition happens, and now they have no one to sell to. What do they do? They just let their rum age. Prohibition ends. World War II ends. There's a lot of ultra-aged, incredible rum, and two tiki bar owners, Trader Vic and Don the Beachcomber, are more than happy to acquire Ray and Nephew 17, Myers Mona 30-year, and whatnot. And you can still find these menus online from the 40s with aged rum that will knock your socks off for like 85 cents a pour.
It's unbelievable there. I mean, you mentioned as well that, you know, Salvatore might have had a historically accurate Mai Tai on the menu there. He was selling it for £5, which, you know, wouldn't have been cheap, but also wouldn't have been, you know, unmanageable for most budgets. There's a great part, though, you know, it's at Trader Vic's bars, right, where we're looking at the Mai Tai here. And, you know, given the fact that people almost can't give it away, he's got Ray and Nephew 17-year in his standard spec, and he's selling this cocktail cheap, right? Like, there's no sense of there's a finite stock of this, therefore maybe we should split it with another rum, or maybe we should be somewhat conservative with the pricing or whatnot. It's just like this stuff's flying off the shelves by the sounds of it.
Well, you know, as I said, you know, soldiers come back from World War II. They want this kind of, now we know, phony, tropical Polynesian life. Trader Vic and Don the Beachcomber more than happy to give it to them. Concurrently, all the island nations have this incredibly aged rum they haven't been able to sell for a while. It doesn't go to retail shelves as far as we know. It goes to these bars. And Martin Cate, the owner of Smuggler's Cove, he's quoted in my book. And I think he says, Trader Vic, slow your roll. Why are you putting 17-year-old Ray and Nephew into your flagship cocktail that you're selling hundreds of a night? And he sells so many that Ray and Nephew has to start selling him 15-year-old. And then it goes down to their Dagger line, which, and these are all coveted in retrospect, but he's just absolutely clearing the earth of vintage-age Jamaican rum that's off the hook.
Is there a sense that, you know, at some point they're trying to keep up with production? Is there a sense that at any point the distillery is like, oh, you know, we need to start plant. If things keep on at this clip, you know, we probably got to start putting more in barrels fast, or they're not too concerned themselves. They're just happy to sell the stuff.
I think after those 13 terrible years of prohibition, they're like, this crazy Californian is taking anything we send him off our hands and selling 500 Mai Tais a night. We will just keep sending the barrels up there as fast as we can make them. So no, I don't think there was any let's tuck away more and have some 17-year-old by what, 1963, when quite frankly, again, America wouldn't have wanted it.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think that was occurring.
And certainly Vic isn't thinking about that either. And you know, this is a really great bottle to highlight, because as you mentioned, I think there's only, what, Martin Kate has one of the bottles, someone mm-hmm. else has the other one, and then there is at the now Campari-owned, you know, property or whatever, they have a half empty bottle in a case display somewhere. Am I correct in remembering that you said it's actually somewhat easier now to find Ray Nephew 20, but it's not as coveted, perhaps not because of the ties to that, because it doesn't have the ties to that drink?
Well,
not easy by any stretch of the imagination, but there may exist more than two bottles that we know of.
Yeah, I think there's more of the 15-year-old, certainly more of the 15-year-old, and perhaps the 20 as well. Yeah, you're right. I mean, we might be talking dozens. Eric Witz, who I mentioned, he also believes that at one time he had a Ray and Nephew 15 in his early Dusty Hunting. It was an unlabeled Ray and Nephew bottle, and taste profile and whatnot, he believes it was a 15, and he did make himself a classic spec Mai Tai using it. So he might be the only American still alive who's had a Trader Vic's Mai Tai.
Mm-hmm. Here's another thing to just fast forward to the future for a second here, because we've got a number of other categories to cover, but there is a sense now that some brands are starting to catch on to this. So, you know, recently, we covered on VinePair the fact that Old Forester's released the 1924 Prohibition Collection or whatever.
Yeah, love
it. Yeah, great whiskey. And they're basically saying that, like, this is the recipe that we legally distilled during Prohibition. We're putting it out. This is what the whiskey would have tasted like. Of course, it's modern day whiskey. But on the other hand, you have a brand, you have Appleton Estate. Last year, 2023, I know you've tasted it and I haven't, so I'll let you take the story from here.
Yeah, my book was 1 week away from getting sent to the printers, and I literally had a line saying, for the life of me, I do not know why Appleton Estate, who owns Ray and Nephew, has not re-released a Ray and Nephew 17. In this final week, I get a press release. Guess what? We're about to release a 17. I think they make a bit of a mistake. They don't call it Ray and Nephew 17. They call it Appleton Legend 17. They claim it's based on the flavor profile. They created new marks. That's what a flavor profile of rum is known as. And I think they have 8 different marks. The rum people are getting furious at all my incorrect information. But anyways, they made, I don't know, 1,200 bottles. I got to try it neat, and I got to try it in a Mai Tai.
I believe it's on a cocktail menu somewhere here in the U.S. Our friend in common that we have, Brad Jaffe, I think was trying somewhere in Chicago.
Three Dots and a Dash has $1,000 Mai Tai or something. Well, the Appleton Estate Legend 17, I think it only sold for $500 retail. I don't know what its secondary price is. I would have bought it all day at that. But yeah, it was quite good.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, like those are just two standout releases that we've seen recently. I'm sure there are tons more as well. But to dip back into the past here again.
Okay.
So those are kind of some of the main spirits categories that, like we said, had this kind of line that you cross a major event that contributed to their value and why people want them. There's some others here that it kind of does also lean into, but also not. We mentioned Creme de Violette earlier. I think we've mentioned enough that we need to talk about, you know, the aviation for today. Not a very.
You haven't done an episode on the aviation?
We haven't yet. We haven't found a bartender that would take it. Although I think Frank Caiafa wants that one. But another one here where you can combine multiple vintage products again. Let's start with a Campari. Is there anything that makes Campari or vintage Campari notable?
Yeah, well, you know, I said spirits are liquid time capsules. That's except for liqueurs, which do change a bit in the bottle. You know, the
great point.
Booziness might mellow out if it's a particularly hot liqueur like chartreuse. The sugar kind of smooths out, intensifies. Certain botanicals get elevated, certain disappear. So it does change, and it can be quite pleasant. With liqueurs, you're also going to have to be careful where it was stored. You know, you can store, you know, bonded American whiskey in a boiler room. Yeah. It's probably going to be all right. When we're getting into liqueurs and vermouths, they're going to want to make sure they were stored in someplace fairly temperate. Mm-hmm. Campari, the obvious one, is pre, 2006, when they were using, you know, famously bugs to color it red.
Cochineal.
I can never know how to pronounce it.
Me neither. I was hoping you would go for it, but it felt like you weren't going to.
I live on the page. I've so many times been like speaking to a crowd and I'm about to say a word that I've only written down. And I'm like, oh shit, I don't know how to say this actually. Cochineal. Might be right.
Yeah, sure.
No one else knows out there. The funny thing is there's a few countries that don't allow for artificial dyes, Mexico among them. And I think I mentioned in this book, you know, you go to a taqueria in New York, it says Mexican Coke on the menu, and we get all horny and go, oh yeah, why is no bar gone? We got Mexican Campari. That's a free idea, guys.
I think we're starting something today. I read that yesterday as I was preparing for today, and I'm like, a light bulb went off, and I'm like, when's my next trip down south of the border?
That's a free idea, Mexican Campari. I've drank a lot of vintage Campari. I like old Campari from the past. I haven't done any sort of vertical to taste whether the bugs actually change the flavor profile. That would be interesting. Certain reasons people collect vintage spirits have nothing to necessarily do with taste, but old Campari is delicious and a critical ingredient for a lot of vintage cocktails, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think I maybe introduced that by talking about the cocktail. The obvious one was the Negroni, because the Negroni is a Campari cocktail, as we always say here. It's not a gin drink. It's not a vermouth drink.
I agree.
The next one, too, here's one where I viewed it as like there is a historical aspect to it, but I don't think that the event is what makes this really coveted. And it also plays a really large part in one very notable, sadly now shuttered bar here in New York.
Yes.
We're talking, of course, about Chartreuse.
Yeah. And, you know, and we mentioned, you know, that Salvatore was the first vintage spirits collector. Eric Witz tipped me off to this incredible New Yorker article from 1956 talking about a vintage Chartreuse tasting. Amazing. I had never even considered that it had gone back that far. And then I found a New York Times article about a Benedictine collector from the 30s or whatnot. Chartreuse is delicious. I think we all agree, no matter what year it is. The interesting thing with Chartreuse is the monks were expelled from the country at one point. The country started hating clergymen for some reason. I don't really know what's going on in France.
I mean, France typically, you know, we've seen their attitudes towards royal families over the years and whatnot, and just authority figures in general or whatnot. So, you know.
So they're like, let's get these monks that don't talk and make the booziest, most delicious liqueur. Let's kick their asses to Spain.
They went to Spain, which, so of course, and I think you mentioned as well, like, officially, maybe they're banished to a certain extent for quite a stretch. But actually, within a couple of decades, a few were able to sort of start streaming back in. But
yeah,
the distinction there being that, like, pre-expulsion is obviously going to be worth more if we look at these kind of somewhat arbitrary things. And then also the period where they continued to produce in Spain, that's correct. Those bottles would also be very rare today.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you know, we can debate the flavor quality. I mean, pre-expulsion is very, very old. You know, chartreuse is costly today. It's, you know, $70 retail, and, you know, with this fake allocation of it right now, it's sometimes even more. You know, a 1903 bottle of chartreuse, I can't even imagine. Chartreuse is the one kind of non-bourbon that captured bourbon guys' imaginations in this early dusty hunting era.
Which is so weird.
Yeah, it doesn't really match the flavor profile. It's an off-putting flavor profile to a lot of people. Bourbon's a very pleasant flavor profile. People either get chartreuse or they don't. Yeah, I always found that interesting as well. But, you know, all vintage chartreuse is extremely collectible, often very delicious. And another reason why chartreuse became kind of a vintage thing is the bottles almost never change. So me, you, and everyone listening has been in a liquor store before and not realized like a 50-year-old bottle of chartreuse was just sitting on the shelves that, that no one had bought because it looked exactly the same aside from the importer information.
Well, I mean, again, handily in your book, you have the guide for how to very quickly and very easily detect if you should find one such dusty chartreuse or something that you suspect has been hanging around for a while. There's a very easy guide in there. Again, urge people to go out and buy that and find out for themselves because it's a lot easier than I knew. There's not really much sleuthing involved in that at all. But we mentioned the bar too, and in particular, well,
yeah,
the name that might be most well known here is Joaquin Simo, but it's not only
sure.
Joaquin, it's his partner there. Tell us this story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, famous barman in New York, and they were opening a new bar in East Village, Alphabet City. What is that? Avenue A? Avenue B? Where was it?
My geography down that part of town is not great, but it's definitely,
It was a bit of a walk.
Yeah, it's not close.
They're opening a bar called Pouring Ribbons, and, you know, here in the greatest city on earth, you got to differentiate yourselves, and they thought, what if we did vintage chartreuse? And this was old enough that eBay still sold legally vintage spirits. So they started snapping up vintage chartreuse. And as far as I know, at least in America, they're the only bar that has dedicated themselves to vintage chartreuse. Canon has a lot of vintage chartreuse too, but this was their shtick. You could get flights of it. You could get cocktails of it. Sadly, it is now gone, not because of the pandemic, but because of greedy landlords here in New York. But they had quite a large collection and a lot of very interesting bottles. I detail how they had one of their oddest bottles was they had chartreuse's base. So
that's right.
The brandy, and I didn't even know till Joaquin told me that I guess chartreuse's brandy based, which kind of makes sense. It's French brandy based until the, you know, sugars and botanicals are added. So they had a bottle of aged brandy base that eventually become chartreuse.
And, you know, Joaquin Simo would be remiss of us not to mention here that the only ever guest on Cocktail College to arrive in our studio with a vintage spirit. if folks haven't listened to that episode, it was, of course, the sidecar. And, you know, I was surprised that Aaron turned up empty-handed today, but he did. But Joaquin turned up, I believe.
I had to go somewhere afterwards. I didn't want a car.
You thought we wouldn't finish it here?
Fair.
No, I think Joaquin turned up with a 1940s era cognac to make a sidecar with. So again, ahead of the game.
Damn.
There Joaquin was with the cocktail making.
So ashamed.
But so I think that's a really notable one. And again, I'm sorry, I mentioned earlier, it was Joaquin's partner, I think you mentioned, that might have had the first taste and been like, wow, this is interesting.
Yeah.
But I forget their name. Sorry about that. But I want us to rattle through four more categories here before we move on to the next section of the show. I'm going to ask you a simple question for each one. Gin. Are people collecting vintage gin? And if so, why? What are they looking for? What's notable?
Well, you know, I think gin is what kind of jumpstarts the need for vintage cocktails because there's so much out there. And, you know, these bourbon collectors just start getting bottles. No one really drinks vintage gin. Maybe you do, Tim, in your vermouthless martini. But it's not really a thing normal people drink. And I don't know if either me or you are normal. But, you know, it's certainly not something you can sell for $50 a pour, a 1960s Beefeater. So you got to turn that into something. And until recently, vintage gin was fairly cheap. Vintage vermouth was almost free because of the oxidation, you know, possibilities. So vintage gin has mainly been a key ingredient in all the vintage cocktails. Now, with vintage gin, It's not going to go bad, but again, some botanicals drop, mainly the citrus ones, and some elevate. There's no rhyme or reason to what happens. People have drank vintage gins and gone, is there juniper in here? I can't even taste juniper. Other times, that's all people can taste. You know, a lot of wacky stuff happens with vintage spirits.
Well, you know, all great points there. And Aaron, you gave the top tip earlier about Campari and heading south to Mexico to maybe getting that. We're going to offer up the second Cocktail College top tip here today, specifically relating to dusty hunting and vintage bottles. You can do this in real time now. We speak about it a lot on the show. You and I have worked on a fantastic article on this before, but if you want to start amassing a collection that will be worth a lot of money eventually in the future, head out there, start stocking up on Beefeater at 47% ABV, and now also 44%. You can do that in real time now.
Yeah, I mean, when I heard about dusty hunting in 2012 or so, I said, the game's already over, why waste my time? But if I'd committed myself, I'd have an incredible collection now. So now you are listening. The best time to start is today. The next best is tomorrow.
And it's you know, those higher ABV Beefeaters. And again, here's the second part of that tip. That's right, you get one here and right now. My experience, at least, and I want to get yours on this, is that if you are trying to look for those Beefeater bottles that are higher ABV, I don't know why I'm giving away my top tips here, but that's the kind of people we are. Go for the handles. Go for the large format. I've found so many 1.75, 47% ABVs these days recently because most people still don't drink a lot of gin in the US. And if they do, they're buying a 750, right? So look
and
for the liters.
Yeah, they're almost certainly buying, you know, some terrible craft gin that tastes like whatever.
Or if they're buying a handle of gin, they're probably going cheaper on the price. But again, phenomenal value. Let us know. Let us know if you pursue that. Want to hear how that goes. But next spirit here, vodka. Why?
Vodka's an interesting one. And I presume there was no vintage vodka collecting to speak of. Anyone who would fetishize spirits so much would surely not drink vodka, much less old vodka. Vodka's also interesting because it really doesn't appear in America till the 60s, with slight exception. Well, Seth Weinberg, who is about to open a vintage brick and mortar in Nashville, told me the reason why you collect vintage vodka, because one day your vintage bourbon friend is going to take you to a vintage vodka bar and you're the wet blanket who only drinks vodka. And so you're going to have to drink vodka at the vintage bar. So he's amassing vintage vodka to serve the vodka-only drinkers.
You know, I've long been somewhat of a different opinion to that.
I think I
like vodka personally. I think there's a lot of... in last week's episode, actually, we covered the vodka martini. I think we might have opened a few people's eyes. But I think vodka, it's just about how you enjoy it and what you're enjoying. And certainly, too, like... production methods have changed over the years, but maybe vintage, you might be looking at something that looks more like a pot still or a hybrid still or still, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they almost certainly lacked the ability to make a purely neutral spirit back then. I've actually never had a vintage vodka. I think I could if I put a modicum of effort, but I you know, I've never been particularly been interested. But yeah, you're right. Production methods were not as locked in as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So it would definitely have
more
probably
character.
More texture and more character. And we're going to get to a point where I think maybe the most signature vintage cocktail necessitates vodka.
Exactly.
So you need that vodka.
We're getting there very soon. You touched upon it before, though. Next one I have on the list here is vermouth. Simple question, yay or nay, and if so, best practices.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a big debate. Not a big enough debate to get into fights, but a lot, I think, well, it's a big question. You know, vermouth is almost certainly going to be oxidized somewhat, vintage vermouth. So you got to know how it was stored. So should a vintage Manhattan, Negroni, Martini have vintage vermouth? I personally feel like yes. Even though, obviously, if you drank a 1960s martini in 1960, there would have been no oxidation. I think that makes it interesting. Others, I think, who own bars think if I'm serving a $100 martini to someone, everything should be locked in.
True.
It's an interesting debate. I think I think the bar owner should open the vermouth, make sure it's not exceptionally oxidized. And I should say, I like slightly oxidized sweet vermouth, certainly. dry vermouth I can handle. And, you know, they should see how oxidized it is and then work from there. But, you know, I go with use the vintage vermouth in cocktails. Mm-hmm.
But again, this is one, like you said, where if you're buying it, if you're hunting it, you got to take extra care to learn a little bit more. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Learn where it was stored. Are these wine drinkers who have some kind of storage, or was this thing sitting on top of a radiator for 50 years? Final one here that really surprised me and I found astounding and super interesting. It's a cocktail ingredient. It's not quite like everything else. It's bitters. You touched upon it earlier. Tell us about bitters, possibly one of the hardest categories to collect.
So I always wondered why, you know, I spend time on the mysterious places where people sell these spirits, which are semi-illegal to fully illegal to, you know, I shouldn't be telling you about this or you'll shoot me.
You're purely talking about, though, the fact that they're being sold there, not the products themselves.
Yeah. And I never would see vintage bitters for sale. And then it hit me, bitters, for the most part, has been sold in supermarkets. Maybe that's why. But then I was told, no, there's just some major collectors of bitters throughout the world that amass every single bottle of vintage bitters and just kind of have like a monopoly on vintage bitters. That's what I'm told.
It's like the Underberg drinkers.
Yeah.
But you mentioned it earlier. I don't think we need to get too much into it here, but, you know, one notable bottle there was Abbott's. Again, I think that's one to, again, buy the book for and read it.
Yeah, that's another thing. There weren't, you know, today there's hundreds of different bitters. Back then there was Angostura, of course. I think there were a few others. Abbott's was another major one, which was a key ingredient and listed in cocktail books in certain cocktails. Eric Witz, who I keep mentioning, gifted me, I think, a 1940-something decanted bottle of some recently, and it smelled incredible, but I don't exactly know what to do with it.
Well, you know, speaking of what to do with what, I want to move us on here, and, you know, I'm going to thank the listeners because that's a lot been more, you know, information about spirits and different types of drinks and background here. We are, of course, a cocktail show, and we've spoken about cocktails throughout, but I want to purely focus on cocktails here.
Yeah.
And I've got a little game for you. I've got a little challenge for you here today. I would like you to rank, based upon your experience and your knowledge, let's say five of the most iconic vintage cocktails you can make today, ranking from most commonly found to maybe ultimate jewel, number one, something that everyone would want to try. And I'm going to add the stipulation there that at least two or a majority of the ingredients have to be vintage. You know, we didn't talk about tequila today because margarita, everything's fresh, basically, apart from the tequila. So maybe one for another day. But tell me, give me a ranking of five vintage cocktails.
Well, you know, I agree with you. I have personally no interest in a vintage cocktail with juice in it. Jamie Boudreau at Canon has vintage cocktails with juice in it. He notes the ingredient, you know, gin circa whatever, you know, this circa whatever, lime juice circa, you know, today, which I think is funny. I kind of feel like it should be 100% vintage. That's why I like the vermouth and whatnot. And so I think the Negroni is the quintessential vintage cocktail. It's the one I see the most. In terms of ingredients, you're using gin, so you're not going to have to beef it up with bourbon. A vintage Manhattan would be quite price prohibited compared to a Negroni or a Martini. So I think the Negroni's number one. You get three different vintage ingredients. Quite nice.
Nice, yeah.
And, you know, if the sweet vermouth is oxidized a bit, just adds to the complexity.
Yeah, a little bit more character in there for sure.
Exactly. I would say number two is the Manhattan and the Martini.
So we're going five through one. One through five. Yeah.
One through five. I guess I should have gone the other one. Whatever.
Yeah, okay. It's fine.
Okay. Manhattan and Negroni, that's, you know, a spirit with vermouth, so it's kind of the same thing. You'll typically see Martinis more than Manhattans. Again, I think that's probably because gin is a little cheaper and needs to be used compared to bourbon, which you could easily just sell you know,
mm-hmm.
as a neat pour. Also, there's just a lot of vintage has to do with the feeling it evokes, and drinking like a 1960s martini, it just feels like it feels good and romantic.
It's the Don Draper effect, like
Don Draper, yeah, Frank Sinatra,
yeah, exactly.
You know. The Manhattan, sure, that's classic too, but the martini, maybe in an old school vintage glass, wow.
Yeah.
How good does that feel?
Exactly. And also, you know, given the price, you know, even if it's whether it's bourbon or rye, and rye is maybe a whole other category when you talk about like different styles of rye from the past, which are being resurrected
sure.
these days. But, you know, those are products for which there's a much greater demand, right? And so therefore, it's going to be harder to price those accordingly and to taste them. So
yeah. And I mean, I think Don Draper was probably using like Canadian Club in his Manhattans too.
Exactly. Probably not a lot of vintage demand for that,
yeah,
but who
yeah.
knows? All right. That's the first three of our drinks here for today.
So next I'm going to do the Sazerac, which I think is quite interesting. You know, there is the debate about whether rye or cognac goes into it. I think modern scholarship agrees that cognac was actually never in it. It's always been a rye drink, but I see a lot of bars, as I said, I looked at Cannon's menu today. They give you the option of either rye or cognac. Same with Maison Premier. I like them with either spirit. I like them with a split base, vintage split base.
Nice.
Now you're balling. I think the Sazerac's also interesting because if you think about it, absinthe was banned in America from 1912 to 2007.
Exactly. We didn't even get into that.
Right. So you're not, for the most part, you're not going to be using a vintage absinthe. It's going to be Pernod or something.
Or you're getting something from somewhere very dusty in Europe. Who knows? But yeah, or you're using vintage Pernod or you know, like pasties, like you said, you know, those two kind of things, or Ricard even. So yeah, the Sazerac's a good one. Also, it's just a better drink than the Manhattan or the old fashioned anyway, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's a drinker's drink.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to do for fifth, I'm going to do my fifth and then we'll get to the other one. Personally, I do not like vintage juice drinks, as I said. So I would put the Mai Tai fifth. You know, if I found a Ray and Nephew 17, if someone said to me, I'll give you 2 ounces of Ray and Nephew 17, you can have a vintage Mai Tai or just drink it neat. It's a no-brainer. I'm drinking it neat.
Really?
I'm not making a Mai Tai. Even if I would get inducted into that class of like five people who have ever had a Mai Tai, I'd still rather taste the Ray and Nephew 17 neat. I don't want it. And I'm going to know that I'm having it with fresh citrus. There's no such thing as vintage orgeat, or vintage orgeat probably has botulism in it or whatnot.
But you got the Curacao, which could be.
Could be. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Or
absolutely.
You could go down. I know one of your favorite pours is the old Grand Marnier, Louis Alexander. You could go down.
No, there's definitely sprung a somewhat market for vintage orange liqueurs. No doubt.
Probably for the sidecar, maybe even for the margarita. Probably not. We'll see. But yeah.
I think vintage, you know, as I said, you know, I think using modern juice kind of takes away the spirit of a mm-hmm. vintage cocktail.
I'm just going to say this, and this isn't to be contrarian. This isn't to be whatever. I'm like,
I'm the contrarian here. Most people disagree with me. I think.
Most people, you think? Because I would totally go with a Mai Tai.
Okay.
Not just to be part of the club, just to be like, all right, whatever. I tried it. I'm like, it might not even be a good drink. You know what I mean? But that's what I go for. All right.
I mean, the real bummer would be if the Ray and Nephew 17 neat tasted terrible.
Exactly.
And the Mai Tai was necessary to elevate it. So
could be the case. We'll never. I mean, there's probably, yeah, like you said, four or five people out there who know the answer to that. Neither of them are sat in this studio. All right, then. Well, you know, we like to round out each episode here with a cocktail and with a spec. So here it is. Am I right in thinking, therefore, we're about to explore your ultimate
yeah.
vintage cocktail on the show today?
Yes. And this is kind of a weird choice because I pretty much hate modern versions of this. I think it's a silly cocktail. It's not a cocktail that was created by a bartender. It's a cocktail that was created by a writer. And why would you ever care what a writer created? A cocktail that he created and then later tasted and said, what have I done? This cocktail sucks. And that's the Vesper.
I like it.
Created by Ian Fleming for 1953's Casino Royale, the mm-hmm. book. Shaken, not stirred. But I think this is actually a very interesting vintage cocktail. apart from the Negroni, Martini, Sazerac, whatnot, because it uses an ingredient that no longer exists, and it's an all-spirit cocktail. So, you know, my specs would be three parts Gordon's gin, as specified in James Bond, 1953's Gordon's gin, one part 1953 Smirnoff, and then a half part Quina Lillet. Lillet exists these days. Quina Lillet does not.
Exactly. So we've lost that quinine. It's come up a ton in the show. It's come up when we covered the Vesper. It's come up when we've covered other drinks that typically include that these days. We've had alternatives. Here's a question for you.
Yes.
You've got those ingredients in front of you.
Yes.
You have the exact proportion.
And none of those ingredients I would want to drink by themselves. So that's why I think this is kind of the pinnacle of a...
It is the pinnacle of vintage cocktails. But would you then shake it as is written in the book? Or would you say, you know what? I want this drink to taste as good as it possibly can. I'm going to stir it.
That's a tough one. That is a very tough one. Because you got to presume they had crappy ice back then, too. I don't need any vintage ice. I want my superior ice.
You don't want a vintage lemon either.
Man, that's a tough call. What would you do? I think I would stir it.
I think I would. Yeah. You'd have to stir that one. No, I think it's a great thought experiment. So anywhere in the world serving those vintage Vespers?
Well, so Salvatore, from what I understand, is the biggest owner, possessor of Quina Lillet on planet Earth. And so he's very big into these Vespers. I have never had one from him, but, you know, when I talked to him for the book and, you know, he's a vibrant man still in his 70s. He Zoomed with me, you know, didn't need some assistant to get him on Zoom. He's locked in. He had just acquired two new bottles of Quina from the 50s or 60s. He is still very much on the hunt 40 years into it.
As are we.
So I think he's associated with a bar called, I forget what bar he's associated. He's associated with a few bars in Europe still, and they almost certainly will have a Vesper on the menu.
Fantastic. That is one I got to see out right now. Yes. You know, and I can hear it right now, friend of the show, because I was just having this conversation with him a few days ago, friend of the show, Souther Teague, you know.
Yes.
His famous thoughts on this drink, I think he says that, would you dilute Coca-Cola with water before you drink it? No. Why are you adding vodka to gin?
And that's also how I feel.
And as you said, it was invented by a writer, not a bartender, for also a character, a person that didn't exist. I disagree. I still think that this can be a good drink, and I would love to try this Vesper.
All right, next round's on you.
Aaron, I got one final question for you today before we, you know, round things out as we do with our quick hit questions, our weekly questions. Book will have come out by the time this episode's out, but book's coming out very soon, as you know, as we're recording this. How prepared are you for the fact that you're just going to get so many people emailing you and DMing yes. you on Instagram, just being like, I found this. Is it worth anything? You know, this is going to be the rest of your life for the next year.
Well, I wasn't prepared until yesterday when I got three DMs. The first DM, terrible blended scotch in grandma's basement. Second DM, slightly better blended scotch. The third DM, and this is what kind of makes it all worthwhile. I got to tell a woman, I think you have about a $5,000 bottle of Old Fitzgerald Stitzelweller from the 60s. So congratulations. I'm happy to take it off your hands for a lot less than that. I'm also happy to drink it with you. I hope at least you bought a damn book for my free appraisal.
Well, you know what? We're going to put all the info there in the description. It's already there as this episode's published, but we're going to put the info for the book. I know Aaron likes to support local bookstores himself. You know, he's a prolific author. He has a number of releases out there. So we're going to put a link up there. But also, this is a very opportune moment to announce to the listeners that if they want to get in contact with Aaron through ourselves here at the show, we just launched a new email address for Cocktail College. It's very simple. It's cocktailcollege@vinepair.com because, you know, I mentioned earlier we had the Sunken Harbor Club live recording. What was incredible was to meet the listeners after the show and spend some face-to-face time with them, chatting with them. And we realized there's not really this great way for us to directly interact. So folks listening there, if you want to get Aaron's appraisal, if you have any, you know, look, if you have any cocktails that we haven't covered yet, or if something comes up in an episode where you're like, oh, I think I miss that spec or I can't quite understand that, feel free to reach out to us. We're always happy to respond. That's it. Again, it's cocktailcollege@vinepair.com. But Aaron, we have some final business to attend to today. We're going to start, as we always do, with question number one. And, you know, we're going to tweak these because, you know, you're not a professional bartender. You're a professional drinker and writer. So, you know, we'll view the questions through that lens. But number one, of course, is what style or category of spirit typically enjoys the most real estate on your bar?
You know, much to my wife's consternation, there's a lot of booze in my house. It's still bourbon is the most, but it's not necessarily what I drink the most these days. I drink a lot of agave, rum, brandy. I came in here, I said, what kind of rum you got we can drink? I drink anything that's interesting, but bourbon still has the most real estate, and that'll be hard to ever get taken over by.
And I think as well, like, definitely not taking up the most real estate, but there's a chapter in there in the book, which is, you know, surprisingly kind of sentimental, which is on about, like, drink something from before you were born or drink something from your birth year. I believe we don't need to mention what it was, but I believe you recently celebrated a somewhat major birthday in your life. And your wife very kindly gifted you a bottle of a birth year Armagnac.
She didn't gift it. I paid for it myself.
I thought that was a present from your wife.
Yeah, I wish. Now she got me something else we can discuss.
Okay. Very nice. But yeah, you celebrate. That's how you celebrate.
I'm not much of a vintage collector, both due to laziness and, you know, economics. You'll find a lot of these vintage collectors don't have children. I do. But no, I like to collect my birth year. It's 1979. So what? I'm not the oldest person who's ever been on the show. 1979 bourbon has gotten pretty expensive, but cognacs and Armagnacs from the era, still fairly thrifty and incredibly delicious.
And you know, still very much on the precipice of becoming the next big vodka, the next vodka, as we learned in The Sopranos.
The next. Artie Bucco in the house.
All right, question number two for you here today. Which ingredient or tool do you believe to be the most undervalued in a bartender's arsenal?
So I want to speak as a home bartender and someone who goes to other home bartenders' houses or just average Joe's houses. I'm a dad in Park Slope, and I go to a lot of mom and dad's houses in Park Slope. And maybe they have incredible booze collections. They often do. They always have terrible refrigerator ice. You don't need the Camper English incredible ice. Just get a damp silicone mold. I don't want those like oblong cubes that are like always like mushy. And they always have terrible glassware. I cannot believe I go to these incredible brownstones in Brooklyn. I want a cocktail and they don't have anything to serve me a drink up in. Invest in four coupes, four Nick and Noras. I'll get them for you on your next birthday. Like, how can you be an adult with no up glassware?
There you have it, people. Take a long, hard look at yourselves in the mirror.
You don't have any, you know, you're serving me an up drink in your John Stockton glass from McDonald's you got for free with your Happy Meal? Come on.
Gotta keep that top of mind. All right, then. And again, this one's probably going to relate more to, you know, being a prolific writer and being in media and drinks journalism. But what's the most important piece of advice you've received while working in our industry?
You know, I don't get a lot of advice because I'm a freelancer and I just sit at home. It's kind of just like submit on time. No, I honestly, you know, I don't know if someone gave me this advice. If you're a freelancer trying to make it in the industry, just, you know, don't be argumentative. Turn things in on time. You know, do you really need to argue about a comma or something? Just behave yourself privately. If you're angry, you can shit on your bosses to other people in your position, you know, but you don't need to make public scenes. Just behave yourself.
I think those are wise words, and I think there's a reason that, you know, again, as I mentioned one last time here, you are such a prolific author and writer, so there we go.
Yeah.
Aaron, penultimate question. If you could only visit one last bar in your life, what would it be?
That is a really tough one. You don't want to think about getting down to the last visit. I loved Existing Conditions. Are you allowed to visit a bar that doesn't exist?
Absolutely.
That was my favorite bar in Manhattan. It kind of hit the wheelhouse for me of like complex drinks served without the pretension. You could just drink them, or if you felt like investing and learning about them, you could also have a 2-hour conversation. As we all know, some of those people still write for you now. laid back atmosphere, not pretentious at all. I would like to go there one more time, and I hope it's revived one day.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, a number of those wonderful folks have been on the show. Our listeners will be very familiar with them. Aaron, final question for you here today. If you knew that the next cocktail you drank was going to be your last, what would you order or make?
Well, you know, we neglected to mention that you know, Salvador Calabresi, I think in 2012, made the world's oldest and most expensive cocktail. It used 750 years worth of ingredients, you know, a 300-year-old cognac, a 200-year-old whatever. He's in the Guinness Book of World Records for that. I think it costs like $2,000. I think he served at the Playboy Club when he was their beverage director. How cool a job is that?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to pick that. Why wouldn't I just have a Tommy's Margarita?
Is that what you go for?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know you as well as I thought I did. I wrote down on my piece of paper here
the
drink that I thought it was. And you know, we didn't get into it today. I thought we might. And I don't want to overshadow your answer here. You know, Tommy's Margarita, by the way, phenomenal drink.
Yeah.
You're going out happy. If it indeed is
the problem is I can drink Tommy's Margaritas in like 5 seconds. They're so delicious.
You could order a pint of it. I don't know.
Yeah, a pitcher of Tommy's Margarita.
I'm going to hand you over the paper here. You can read the drink that I thought you were going to say.
Oh, wow. A zombie. That's interesting. Why did you think that?
It's very boozy.
That's true.
You like tiki.
I do.
You like a project.
Yes.
And there was also, and again, we didn't get into it today, but again, folks, look it up in Aaron's book, the whole zombie aspect of this. So I just felt like maybe you were going out on a buzz, the zombie. But I love the Tommy's Margarita.
That's
great drink.
Philosophically a very good and interesting answer. I don't know. Maybe if I was writing it, I would do that.
I've been considering this a lot more, having sat in this seat many,
yeah,
you know, multiple times.
Yeah, that's a
times,
good answer.
You know. You know, Aaron, before we go, just want to point out as well to the listeners, you know, if you're enjoying what we're doing here at Cocktail College, if you're picking up what we're putting down, check out the rest of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. We've got the flagship Vine Pair Podcast, you know, twice a week, keeping up on industry trends, hot talking points. Every Wednesday, we got Vine Pair's Wine 101, Keith Beavers, the place to go for wine education. And of course, on Tuesdays, our mutual friend and colleague, Dave Infante, Tap Lines. With very recently Wolfgang Puck.
Unbelievable.
What's Wolfgang Puck doing on a beer podcast? You'll need to head there to find out.
Amazing.
Aaron, I know you've got more expensive bottles to drink, and you've probably got a little vintage bottle somewhere for your next appointment. You're big on the podcast circuit right now. So listen, thanks for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
It has been fun.
Mm-hmm. Until next time then.
Oh, I can be on again?
I think so. We'll let the listeners reach out. cocktailcollege@vinepair.com. Aaron, cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Cocktail College podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show anywhere near as much as we enjoy making it, go ahead and hit subscribe, and please leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or Stitcher. And please tell your friends. Now for the credits. Cocktail College is recorded in New York City and produced by myself and Darby Seasai, who also composed our awesome theme music. Just give that a listen. I also want to give a huge shout out to everyone on the Vine Pair team, especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Malin, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, and art director Danielle Greenberg, who designed our killer logo. Finally, thank you, listener, for making it this far, and for giving this whole thing a purpose. Until next time. Cocktail College is brought to you by George Dickel. Let me tell you a little story, listener. From the very beginning, as one of the oldest distilleries in Tennessee, George Dickel was determined to do things differently, rethink American whiskey using fresh spring water as well as tried and true distillation techniques. And here's why I'm excited to partner with Dickel today. Because whether you're talking Tennessee whiskey or bourbon, Dickel actually puts both of those different types of spirits out there. You can argue the differences between yourselves. And when it comes to sipping, we're talking high age statements with some of the best value you can find in American whiskey. Seriously, we've been fans here at Vine Pair for years. We've championed Dickel for years, which is why it's so awesome to be partnering today. But this is a cocktail podcast, so let's talk about mixing options. I like to turn to the Dickel Bourbon, which feels just at home in those classic cocktails that we always cover here, as well as those modern classics we like to get into as well. Listener, head to georgedickel.com/recipes to get inspired and start mixing with our old pal, George Dickel. Cheers.